Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Nancy Peacock, who was one of us here in Chapel Hill, now lives in Hillsboro, is quite an accomplished author and also a wonderful writing teacher. What makes me most jealous, I think, is she's just done everything in the whole world. We'll talk about some of that. But many of us are excited about her brand new book, The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson. And she's here to talk about and promote and bring us into this. Nancy, I'm a little more than halfway through this book, and I can't put it, I can't wait for us to finish talking about it so I can finish reading it. And tell us about this guy, Persimmon Wilson.
Persimmon Wilson was a great character to work with. I just love him. He's a strong character. He's very angry, but he's very literate too. He was wonderful to work with. He is an ex-slave, a literate ex-slave who is about to hang for the murder of his former master and the kidnapping and rape, quote unquote, of his former master's wife. He disputes that part of the story. He disputes the fact that this woman is being called the man's wife. He says she's not white. He also committed these crimes while he was riding with the Comanche Indians.
So, all right. So this is this guy's. He's making a. He's going to get hanged in 2 days, and he starts out telling his story. And part of his story is that he was a slave. Most unusual, I guess, in making this story possible is that along the way, somebody, although teaching slaves how to read and write was in most cases forbidden, Persimmon Wilson learned how to read and write, so he can write up a story.
He can write up a story, or I hope he can, if I could. He was taught by a woman up in Virginia. He was born in Virginia and enslaved on a plantation that was belonged to a man named Roland Surly. And he was hired out to this woman every winter along with a boy named Bessel. And the woman just worked them by day, and at night she taught them reading and writing. And every year she hired them out every winter, and she just kept on adding on to their layers of knowledge. And Percy, which is what I call him, seemed to really take to
Percy
it.
Percy, for short, for Persimmon.
Correct.
And that was what most people called him, I guess.
Right.
Now, so he's in Virginia. What happens to him?
Roland Surly dies, and he dies in debt. So his estate has to be liquidated, which means the slaves are sold, and they're auctioned off and separated. Families are split up. He's split up from his mother and father and his sister. They're all sold separately. And he is put on a boat to go down to New Orleans to be sold in the slave market, him and the boy Bessel, who he learned reading and writing with.
He must have done a lot of research for this. Is this the way slaves were transported from the Virginia breeding grounds down
They
to
were
the sugar?
Transported a lot of different ways. They were transported by land. Some of them were walked all the way down there. Some of them were taken by ship. As I researched slavery, I mean, the thing I learned is that every plantation, in a way, was like a world unto itself. So, you know, there were people who treated their slaves better than other people. And you didn't, you know, it was almost lawless in a way. I mean, there were the laws around slavery, but each slave owner got to decide how he was going to treat his slaves and what he could or could not do to them. I did research the slave market in New Orleans and found out a lot of interesting things. I mean, they were lined up. Men and women were put on separate sides of the room. They were lined up by height. They were often dressed up in exactly the same sort of costumes. Sometimes some slaves were sent out to sort of walk up and down the sidewalk, almost like a little window display. It was, you know, it was very interesting and horrifying, really.
Well, we're sort of familiar, closer to home, the Charleston marketplace, which is still in existence, was a slave market, and then the marketplace in Fayetteville were slave markets. So it's not exactly totally a foreign idea to us that there would be these. This would be sort of the main occupation on Saturday, which you'd be selling slaves the same way you sell animals.
Slave markets, you know, everywhere, all up and down the South, and maybe in the North too. I honestly don't know that.
All right, so Persimmon Wilson is a young teenager, I guess, a slave, and he's
about 18.
He goes by boat from Virginia to the New Orleans market, and what happens to him there?
He gets purchased by a man named Joseph Wilson, And when Joseph Wilson purchases him, he also purchases a man named Henry. He purchases Bessel, the boy he came down with. And then he purchases a young woman named Chloe, who is, she's what's called a fancy, which means she's just used basically for men's pleasure. She's very pretty. She's very light-skinned. And Master Wilson takes a liking to her in a certain way. They're transported
so this
to a sugar
is for
plantation.
The, he's buying her as in, at least in part for sexual services.
Yes, although, yeah.
And what were the laws? What were the rules about that, if any?
I don't think there were any. I mean, there was...
So you could buy, if you're a wealthy person in the South, you could buy your own woman to serve you and require that person to perform. Is that sort of the way it worked?
I think that's probably the way it worked, yeah.
Now, tell us as much as you will. I don't think the, I mean, you. We know the end of the book from the beginning, don't we?
Yeah,
I mean,
we do.
So tell us a little more.
He's transported to a sugar plantation where they're growing sugarcane. Sugarcane was hard, hard work. They worked, you know, during grinding season when the cane was being harvested and ground into sugar and processed into sugar. The slaves would work 18-hour days. You know, they were fed. I also researched this. They were fed out in the field. Whatever could be done to make the whole process more efficient was done. And people really wore out in that area. New Orleans falls.
Now wait, Willis. Let me talk about sugarcane.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've heard about this the sugarcane growing from Cuba, and the slaves in Cuba. It was viewed sort of that like this, that in many places slavery it was economically an advantage to treat your slaves well, to keep them healthy, and to keep them reproducing. Because a slave cost so much. In Cuba, in the sugarcane fields, where it's so brutal, right. The economics of it worked a different way. You just knew it was going to kill your slave.
You just wore him out,
and very quickly, in a matter of a few years, so that economically you planned on replacing him rather than caring for them and keeping them for a long mm-hmm. time.
I think that was true.
And it was true down there as well.
Right, and... You know, in regards to the economics of treating your slaves well because they cost so much, I'm not sure that everybody agreed with that. I mean, you can look around now and see that people, you know, people treat their property differently. Some people treat property, and I'm putting property in quotation marks because I don't think people can own people. I don't think that's, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm condoning that. But if there is that argument that slaves were property and that they wouldn't treat their slaves badly because they were mm-hmm. their property. But you can look around you now and see that people treat their property differently. So mm-hmm. I don't think that everybody agreed that—
Some of us run our automobiles in the ground and some people take very
right.
good care. And,
right.
And that was the way it was with slaves, you're saying.
I think so. I mean, I wasn't there.
well, you've
I
taken in your
research.
Book, you've taken me there. And I mean, the complicated thing, which I think is not giving away anything you don't intend to give away as part of the introduction of the book, is that Chloe, this light-skinned, very beautiful woman, is required to perform sexual services for the master. But your hero, Percy, is an attractive black guy, and she is more attracted to him.
They fall in love.
Yeah,
they fall in love. Master Wilson rapes Chloe en route to Sweetmore, his plantation. And Percy just, you know, Percy's also separated from his mother for the first time. And they sort of fall towards each other in a protective way. And they continue to see each other as much as they can, which isn't very often. And they fall deeply in love.
Well, that's part of the basis of the plot of Nancy Peacock's brand new book, The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson. I'm going to try to get her to tell us some more after this short break. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Nancy Peacock. Nancy's well-known in the writing community, both as an accomplished author and also as a teacher of writing. Her latest book, I want to talk about those things before we're through, but I'm most excited about the book. And the part, we've been talking about the part of the book that I've read, and things are complicated on the sugar plantation in Louisiana, where the slave system is running strong and sugar production and sales are profitable. And then the Civil War comes along.
Right.
What happens then?
And New Orleans fell a lot sooner than the rest of the nation fell. The rest of the Confederacy fell. So it fell pretty early in the Civil War. I forget the names of all the characters in who, you know, I guess General Butler was occupying the New Orleans, but he was not the guy who came up the river. The people in Louisiana thought that they were in the safest place they could be, that nobody could
possibly. They're far away from the actual.
Right. You know, nobody's going to come down there and fight a battle. You know, it's all going to be up north of them. So they just did not think anybody could come up the river. There were two forts on either side of the river. It wasn't possible. Well, that's exactly what happened. And New Orleans fell. And a number of plantation owners took their slaves across the river and into Texas to protect their quote-unquote property. They fled.
Because they thought that if their territory fell to the Union forces, the slaves would be free.
Right, yeah.
Or would not be able to discipline. So to protect their property, they leave their to protect their slave property, they leave all the rest of their property.
Right.
And tell us about the research in this. This is a new feature of Civil War history for me.
Oh, really? I had heard, I'd heard these stories, and I did a little research, and you know, indeed, that's what they did, and that's what Percy's master, quote-unquote master, decides to do with his slaves.
You can get property in Texas and start a new sugar plantation?
You know, some of the plantation owners own multiple plantations. Some of them own cotton plantations in Texas. Wilson did not. He was just going to flee. He was going to abandon Sweetmore, take his slaves across the river. You know, they had a lot of stories that they told themselves and they told the slaves, like, you'll be safer over there, all these sorts of things. You know, it was a turbulent time. A lot of slaves ran away. A lot of slaves went down to, you know, hook up with the Union soldiers, with the Union troops. Eventually, they were allowed to serve, to form a militia and, you know, serve the Union. That
well,
didn't
you
happen
even,
immediately.
Well, but you have Persimmon Wilson, your hero, winding up in the Union Army.
Yep, he sure did.
And
served a couple of
well,
years.
What role does that play in the book?
A small role, really. I don't want to give too much away here because I feel like I'm treading on ground. That
well, tell us about the history then of African Americans in the Union forces in the Western Front.
What I know of it, they weren't treated very well. They weren't given good jobs. A lot of them in the beginning just had to dig trenches and do a lot of grunt work. Eventually, they were allowed to fight, and they fought well, and they fought gallantly.
All right, I'm not going to push you to tell any more than you want to about your book, but in the early parts of the book, when we first get to know Persimmon Wilson, he's getting ready to be hanged for the murder of his former master and the rape or the kidnapping of his master's supposed wife. And he's telling his, he's writing up his story. And part of what he says from the very beginning of your book is that he rode with the Indians, and he had been called the N word. He'd been called by the Indians and white people, but some people were more afraid of him as an Indian than they were afraid of him as a black man.
He had a reputation.
How did he get this reputation?
Well, he was riding with Comanche, and the Comanche were pretty fierce, and they were raided down into the settlements of Texas a lot. This was their economy, you know, to raid into these settlements, steal horses, go back to up in the panhandle. And he rode with them, and because he was a black man, he stood out. So I don't know that he was committing any more crimes than anyone else or was any more violence than anyone else that he rode with, but he stood out. And so he gained a reputation by standing out.
So how did the tell us about the Indian acceptance of non-Indian people to ride with them, to be a part of their to be a part of their army?
Yeah, a long time ago, I read a book about called "The Captured" by Scott Zesch, and it's about children who are captured in Texas by the Comanche, and taken away from their families and assimilated into the tribe. And this was very common with children because they were young. The Comanche needed warriors. They needed their birth rate was down. They needed women who could reproduce for them. And a lot of these kids, when the Comanche Nation pretty much fell, were returned to their families once their families were found, and they couldn't fit back into society. It was too hard for them. I mean, some of them eventually did. Others of them, did not.
So how does Percy fit in with them?
Percy does get assimilated into the tribe.
How does he happen to get up with the Indians?
He gets captured.
He captured, and they like him, and they say, we can use you?
Oh, no. He's tortured and put through a whole lot of stuff, and he shows a lot of bravery, and he ends up being put again, I feel like I might be saying too much, but he ends up being put up against somebody in a fight, and he wins the fight. And he decides to stay. He makes that decision.
All right, I'm not going to make you tell anymore.
I know, it's hard.
Yeah, well, you tell as much as you want to, but this is an epic. I mean, this is out of character worth anything you've ever written before.
Right.
And
something happens every chapter.
I mean, what is your model? What got you out of your earlier model of local oriented? Some about the complexities of race, but basically local and fairly modern. I mean, this now you got somebody said this is like Coal Mountain. I mean, this is an epic kind of story.
I don't know why I made that leap exactly. The way it came to me was I was watching Ken Burns' series about the West, and I remembered reading that book that I just mentioned some time ago, and I just wondered. I wonder if there were black Indians. So that's how a novel starts. You just sort of start wondering with a question. And the next day, I continue to sort of think about it, and that opening line, which is, I have been to hangings before, but never my own, that line just came to me. And I liked that line an awful lot.
Well, now, you're getting back into telling part of your story, but you tell this earlier on, so it's not really giving anything away. And this Percy, he's getting ready to be hanged. But he remembers when he was a little boy that he went to a hanging. And what were hangings like back those days?
Oh, they were often, they were public hangings. People gathered, brought picnics. It was a social event to go to a hanging. It probably depends on who was hanging as to who showed up, how many townspeople. If it was a particularly notorious person that they wanted to see hang, then it would be a big party. And this was true. This was true at his hanging, or what is going to be his hanging, what he assumes will be his hanging, because he's sitting in jail and outside.
Got 2 days to go, or
right,
then a day to go. And so, but I think one of the poignant part for me was that he's putting his own hanging in the context of the hanging that he observed, and he got a little token at the hanging.
Right.
Tell us about that.
The hanging he went to was of a man called One-Eyed Jim, who killed an overseer.
So this would have been just
a black man.
I apologize. He would have gone to this hanging at a time when slavery was in place.
Oh yeah, he was a child.
And as a child, his own planned hanging is say in 1875 or so, 10 years after the Civil War. So it's a little bit different environment, I guess, for a hanging.
I'm not sure that it would have been too different an environment out in Texas. The town is called Drunken Bride. And Percy participated in a raid in Drunken Bride. So the people in Drunken Bride are very interested in seeing him hang.
And he's kind of a legendary. He's the black Indian. People have heard about him. They're kind of wanting to see him done away with.
And they want to see him hang for the murder of.
And does Do you think they'll give out these little trinkets of the little nooses that you talked about?
The little nooses is something that he encountered when he was a child, when he went to this hanging with his master, Roland Surly, and Surly was courting this woman at the time, and Percy was just there to carry the basket, spread the quilt, you know, do all these little things, fan her if she got hot. And there were these boys winding through the crowd, and they were selling these little tiny nooses that they'd made. And inside on the rope, they'd written One-Eyed Jim and maybe the date. And they were selling them as souvenirs.
Selling them like at the basketball game, a Beat Duke pin or something like that.
Sure. And did market anything.
And did you make this up, or is this something?
I did make it up.
You did.
Yeah.
It's really a great thing. Now, in the earlier part of your book, so I'm not giving away too much. By the way, you can go to Nancy Peacock's webpage, and you can read the first few pages of this book if you want to. We're talking about those things that are in that first part of it. But it turns out that Persimmon Wilson has other names.
He has his Indian name, which is Kwipanada Tumu, which is Comanche for twist rope.
Well, this kind of goes in with the noose, doesn't it?
In the beginning chapter, he's sort of speculating about what name he'll use if there are boys who make these little nooses and sell them. There probably will not be. There are some souvenirs being sold or that are going to be sold at his hanging. But he's just speculating on that, which name they would use, whether they would use his slave, what he calls his slave name, Persimmon Wilson, or if they will use the translation of his Comanche name, Twist Rope.
Well, this centered around the hanging. I mean, it brings back, a wonderful book about the hanging of Henry Barry Lowry's brother down in Lumberton during the time when the Lumbee were sort of in rebellion, and it's evocative. You hear these stories of the last hanging in Ashe County. There's a big mural picture of how that gathers African American being hanged. So all of this imagery about the hanging haunts us, doesn't it?
Then there's the whole lynching.
Plus the lynching feature.
You know, thing that the South has participated in.
Well, we're talking about The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson, which is the latest book of Nancy Peacock. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Nancy Peacock, who's a well-known writer in the writing community in this area, really across the country. And her latest book is it's an epic, really. I'm about halfway through, and I'm ready to stop this interview so I can finish it up today. But Nancy, this is out of character, and so out of your earlier character. You've transformed your writing, and for me, it takes some courage or something. Did something happen in your life to make you do this?
Maybe. I couldn't think of what it would be. I think, I just grew as a writer, and I try not to be present in my books,
What do you mean about that? What do you mean?
Well, I try to let the character speak through me.
Well, you're the pup. You're the pup. You're the person who's driving.
No.
You're driving the character.
Have you written a novel?
I've never written a novel, and I've talked to many novelists who say I just start writing the novelist, and the main character takes charge in places that I didn't intend to go.
And that's exactly right. I don't think that I never enter it in thinking I'm the one that's in control. I always think that the character is the one that
So you
needs
started
to
this book and you didn't have a beginning or an end. You just let the character go? Is that what?
I had that first chapter. This is the first book I've ever written in which I really knew a lot more at the beginning than I've ever known in past books.
How did you get, if this character directed this book, how did you get to know this character? Where did he come from? This is a literate ex-slave who has become an Indian and who is raiding, the settlements in the West with the Comanche. Was there somebody you read about that inspired this? Where'd he come from?
I think that for a novelist or for me, it's, everything that happens or everything that you read that you're interested in becomes sort of a part of the fabric that I'm writing from. And the more I write fiction, the more able I find that I can step into, you know, other people's shoes and view their lives actually through their own lens rather than through my lens.
There's a lot of skepticism around about white people who write in the voice of black characters. And then there's another strand that is skeptical of women who write in men's voices, or maybe more often of men who try to write in women's voices. Now, you've picked up a double challenge as a white woman, right? As a white woman who lives in the 21st century, writing about a black male, as a free white woman living in the 21st century, writing about an ex-slave black person who's a black male who's living in the 19th century. So you just did this. You didn't have any worries about this.
Oh yeah, I'd already written a book. Home Across the Road was my second novel, and it is largely the point of view of an African American woman. So I sort of had already stretched myself that way, and I was scared to death to write that book for the very reasons that you just said. And I asked myself, do I have a right to do this? I mean, that's what I heard. You know, white people shouldn't write in the voices of African Americans. They don't get it. And I think that's largely can be true, that most white people don't get it. And I don't know if I get everything. But
you got a pretty good reaction from your effort. I'm sure there's some criticism, but you got a pretty good reaction, didn't you?
Well, the thing is we have these divisions, you know, race, gender, all this stuff, but, you know, we're all human and we all have the same thing. And if we're willing to let down those little divisive roles that we're defined by, and that's what fiction writing does. It lets those things down so that I can step into, I mean, if I am a mother and my child is snatched away from me and sold, that's going to feel the same to me if I'm white, black, whatever. You know, that's not going to feel. You can, if you're willing to go into those places, then I'm not saying, you know, I always get it right, but this is my way of exploring places that I'm, you know, the people that I'm not.
If you join us late, Nancy Peacock is talking about her new book, Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson, an ex-slave, an Indian writer who lived in the 1860s and 1870s. As you wrote this book, going through a different way to write, were there some lessons that you learned, or did you just bull ahead using the things that you already knew?
Oh, well, every book, you know, teaches me something new, and whatever I learned in the last book isn't going to serve me in the next book, so it's completely inefficient process. One of the things that really surprised me was that I went into this book having great sympathy for the Indians, and I still do. And I feel like they were displaced from their land. I feel like we committed genocide. I feel like a lot of bad stuff went down. But it surprised me to end up having great sympathy for the settlers out in Texas too. And they were living, I mean, you know, whether or not they were supposed to be there, they were there. And there was a group of people who would sometimes swoop in and snatch their kids and swoop out. And that must have felt pretty terrible. So, you know, I ended up learning a lot about a people who I hadn't intended to really learn that much about, too.
Well, do you have this is the battle, and it's a battle that continues as to whether or not the European settlers had any right to go and take away the Indian lands. And so you started out being very sympathetic to the Indians who were being
displaced,
and now you—
And I still am. I still am sympathetic to the Indians.
Well, I mean, if we hadn't done this, I mean, we wouldn't have had a country, would we? We would have.
Well,
if we hadn't taken it away from the Indians.
Yeah,
we wouldn't have.
It's done. I think we all need to take a look at it, though, and think about it a little more deeply rather than just say, "Oh, that was a long time ago, and it doesn't matter anymore."
Before we stop talking about your book, let's go back to your main character, Persimmon Wilson. And what is it that you like the best about this guy you created? and then drove you and then wrote your book for you?
I don't know if I created him, and I think I wrote the book for him actually. But what do I like best about him is he's very strong. He's very defiant. He has an amazing story, which was really a journey for me to follow. It was an adventure to write this book and find out all the things that I needed to find out in order to write his story. He is transformed in a way in the middle of the book, from being a slave and the victim of slavery to being a warrior. I found that pretty interesting.
Well, that transformation.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is instructive as we go through life, and every now and then something really big makes us, transforms us into a different role or a different person. Well, this is a great book. We're going to take a quick break. We're visiting with Nancy Peacock about her latest book, The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Nancy Peacock. She's written a new book, a wonderful one. It's still brand new, The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson. For the next little while, she's going to keep your eyes open. She'll be reading at the various wonderful local bookstores locally. Nancy, the other thing that I remembered is I got ready to talk to you about your book was you're an enthusiastic sharer of the writing craft and a missionary for writers. I don't want to type you as being more available to women than men, but you are very sympathetic to some of the things that affect women writing, mm-hmm. women writers. Well, tell us what are you doing? What do you do when you teach writers?
You know, writing is such a collective process, and you think it's so lonely, and it is if you want it to be. I tend to write. I take my own work to my writing group and have them, you know, read it to them, have them discuss it, tell me what was clear, tell me what wasn't clear, tell me what they think could be done better, make suggestions, and that's exactly what we do in the groups that I run. You know, we critique each other's work, or we critique their work. And they bring in works in progress, short stories, memoirs. We do some prompt writing, which is free writing.
What's a prompt writing?
Prompt writing is I'll throw out a prompt, such as write about following somebody. Or sometimes I have pictures, and like a picture of place, and I'll say, you know, write about what was lost here. Or I'll put a little toy on the table and show them a picture of a place and say, you know, write a scene and place the toy in the picture. It's just a jumping off place. And I'll set a timer for 15 minutes. And then we just write. And the rules are you write nonstop. You don't edit. You don't worry about spelling, punctuation, or grammar. And if you come upon something that's kind of scary, you just write it. Don't stop. And what that does is, you know, we're always kind of editing at the same time that we're writing. And I think that can be done. But it's also nice to just let it rip, mm-hmm. and see what comes up.
So it's like if I'm driving down a beautiful highway, you say, don't stop. Drive all the way to the end. And then maybe you can come back and revisit some of the places you passed by. But if you stop and start looking at the little places, you'll never get to the end.
I wouldn't make that comparison, because when you're driving down a highway, you're speeding past things. But when you're doing prompt writing, you might be
I love this the distinction. What you taking my analogy and trying to make it worth something, you'd say, yes, you can keep on writing, just don't stop. Don't stop writing.
Don't stop the writing.
Yeah.
And if, you know, so the writing winds into writing something about your mother that you kind of don't want to write.
You can take a detour as long as you don't stop writing.
Well,
you can take a detour in your writing.
What is a detour? I mean,
well, it's something that you get interested in along the way.
Right, then follow it. Follow that thread.
Now, what is that, a 10-minute job, or is that
we do it for 15 minutes. I teach a free class at Flyleaf Books the second Saturday of every month.
So anybody who wants to can just come and you'll Mm-hmm. You'll teach them for free. Now, who comes to the?
And a lot of people come. I get 30 people usually every time. It's for adults. You know, I wouldn't say it was for children. You know, people come in and out of it. Just come.
I'm interested. You know, I have another analogy that I bet you'll reject, which is the writing versus playing golf, and which I can do neither. And so, or fiction writing and golf, I can do neither. And you have a whole bunch of aspiring people who would really like to be stars. Mm-hmm. And some of the golfers, and these are the ones who just keep on playing, they get over the idea that they're going to be a star, and they just enjoy the game. And they want to get better, but they don't aspire to ever beat Tiger Woods. And the same, but those who do are either going to be very successful or going to be very frustrated. Same thing with writers. I've got the impression that there are some people who are more in it because they want to be a best-selling author than they want to have the writing experience.
And I actually like that analogy.
Oh, my golly!
I think everybody has a story to tell, and people come to writing for different reasons. I came to writing because I wanted to be a star.
Oh, really? Okay.
Absolutely. I wrote. I liked writing. But
you wanted to be, of course you wanted to be successful.
Yeah, I wanted to be.
New York Times best-selling author, Nancy Peacock, yeah.
Right, and everything, whatever goes along with that, a paycheck, hopefully. And I had to struggle with the fact that I was still cleaning houses for a living through a good deal of my writing life. And I just had to get used to the fact or accept the fact that I was going to write because I tried to quit. I actually was quitting when this character landed on me. I was like, I'm not writing anymore. I'm done with it. It's not getting me anywhere. And so I was fallow. And I was taking these walks up to see the sunrise every morning. I think I was just really open in a way. And so Percy kind of came in, swept in, and landed on me. And I forget where I was going with that. But I think—
this is what brought you back into writing. Yeah,
the writing of this book.
So you wrote this for here, I'm putting words in your mouth, but more than when you were younger, when you were going to be a star, you said, I'm going to write this because I'd like to be a star again, too. But I'm going to write this because this guy's got hold of me. I love the story.
Because I have to write this book. That's true for my other books, too. But I was more in a place of really recognizing the power of that and the necessity of that, and that was much more important than whether or not I was ever going to be a star.
Well, one of the things that that people are interested in writing, whether they're trying to write their book and find a publisher for it or not, we're all interested in the market. And what's different about selling your book today than it was 15 or 20 years ago?
I've never been very good at it, no matter what the year is. Publishing has really changed. I think I began publishing right when there were, the mid-list authors, as they're called, were kind of in decline, and they were starting to, a lot of publishing houses were being bought up by a few corporations, and they were starting to look at more at celebrity writers and, big selling books and such as that. So, it used to be, so I hear, that you would hook up with an editor, and that editor, an agent, would nurture your career along the way. And that doesn't seem to be true. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I mean, I know there are editors and agents who are nurturing their writers, but everybody seems to be a lot busier these days, mm-hmm. and writing is slow food. And I think that's why this book really worked for me, was I just decided writing is slow food. This is going to take some time. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if, I'm going to win any great prizes for this book, but I've got to follow this story. And
well,
I
should have asked you this early in the interview, but how long did it, when
did
you?
It took me 2 years.
Which is not—
Not that long.
Not that long. So, all right, now I'm curious because you said you threatened to stop writing, which would have been a tragedy. This book brought you back into it.
Right.
Now, where is it now?
Are you
waiting for another Persimmon Wilson to come grab you and teach you how to write another book?
I've got a character kind of tickling at me a little bit, and I'm doing a little research, but I'm not. She has not come to me as fully formed as Percy did. Like I said, every character is different. She seems to be a little more secretive.
Well, we'll tell her to come on out of there
can write a book. Yeah, pull her out. I'm ready.
We're ready for another one of Nancy Peacock's great books. In the meantime, keep a lookout. You'll have a chance to meet her at readings throughout the community as this book is promoted, The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson. Put it on your list. You'll be reading a lot more about it. Nancy Peacock, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin. Who's Talking? I'll be back here before you know it.